Welcome back to Hugging the Cactus, a Mel Gibson podcast. And today we have that special treat. We have the movie everybody wants to talk about, The Patriot. I still have no idea why people want to see this movie ever again. So that's why it's your favorite movie. Tell me, Doug, why should we bother watching this?
You know, Seago, this movie came out in what, 2000? Roundabouts? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed it much more then as a younger man than I did rewatching it for this.
I was questioning your sanity.
I'm a sucker for like a historical drama, whether or not it's accurate, historically accurate. Mm-hmm. I still like the settings. I like the uniforms, you know, and especially like, I know almost nothing about the Revolutionary War. But I just love things that are set back then for some reason. And like I said, it's the settings, it's the costume design and everything that really captures me, you know. Kind of try to put myself in that mindset. Like if I was living in the late 1700s, you know, using the resources that they had back then, you know, how different life would be. And
yes, you know, and everything. Would you butcher a British soldier to death with an axe?
With a tomahawk? Mm. If he killed my son, then yes. No, it's
why not? You know, let's be bloodthirsty here.
Right now, I will say, after watching it again, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I watched it just last night. Mm-hmm. And I still do like the action. I like the war scenes. Sure. Some of the acting is just awful. Atrocious. Awful. Some of the writing is awful.
The writing is worse. And the editing and some of the directorial choices are questionable, to say the least.
Yeah, but I mean, look at it also in the lens of a 2000s director, right? They were after the big bombastic action films.
Well, that worked.
Yeah, but I mean, you sacrifice. If you want to go for that, you sacrifice elsewhere. And they sacrificed in, you know, in story, they sacrificed in acting choices, they sacrificed in directing choices.
Historical story. Accuracy.
Oh my God, yeah. Yeah, I'm tired somewhat of these like historical figures that are put on screen that are an amalgamation of five or six different people, you know, like when we did Braveheart, William Wallace was you know, sort of in that same vein. You know, if you got a guy, you know, I mean, the Revolutionary War had to be chock full of guys that you can tell an accurate historical tale about.
Yeah, and to my knowledge, it's never been done. Not really.
I don't think so. No. And those are the original heroes of our country. I know. I don't even know if you learn about the Revolutionary War at all, being from Europe.
Well, we financed it. So, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Everybody hated Britain back then. They were the world power.
Yeah. They just conquered and, you know, invaded and conquered.
Well, yeah. Basically, Britain was our mortal enemy. Because we were contesting the same sea lanes. Mm-hmm. And Britain was making a very concerted effort to steal all our colonies. One of the biggest ones, of course, was New York itself. That wasn't New York. That was New Amsterdam.
Right.
And most of those people in the in that civil war, in that uprising, were basically just Dutch colonists who did not want to live under the thumb of the British. And basically fomented armed uprising. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. You know, that, you're welcome. It was King George, right? That wanted all the land. He wanted to own the world pretty much, right?
Yes, that too. And well, of course, you want that. You want world domination. Why not?
Yeah.
But I think the American Civil War had mostly had to do with like a well-functioning economy, the leading families, the elites. Pretty good idea that they could do it on their own. What do we need Britain for? We could do that ourselves. They don't really care about us. All they want is money. So that's how that whole taxation without representation came about.
Exactly. Exactly. They were taxing us to the teeth and taking, you know, their share, what they thought was their share of land, of money, of crops or whatever. And one thing I didn't realize was I always thought that the signing of the Declaration of Independence was kind of the end of the war. But that was the main thing that
was the start,
kicked it off. Yeah, because it was the Americans that decided they wanted their independence. And when they signed the Declaration and went to Britain and said, look, they went peacefully saying that this is what we're after. Britain said, stick that up your ass.
Yes.
So the colonies said, okay, let's do this.
The document is actually mostly judicially based on the Dutch one. We did the same thing to the Spanish crown. It was the act of leaving, basically. We proclaimed, we are no longer our king. We're sick of you. Bye-bye. That's it. And so, of course, the next thing the king does is he rents an army and he shows up.
Yeah, yeah. It seems like the king is the common denominator here. Who's the asshole? If royalty. If many different countries think you're the asshole, then guess what? You're the asshole.
I guess so. Yeah, yeah. No, but the irony, of course, is that Britain and what was then the Dutch Republic fought the Spanish together. They fought the Spanish Armada, made up of thousands of ships. The largest armada the world had seen up to that point.
Yeah.
And so we defeated the Spanish armada with help of the sea because there was a really nasty storm. That didn't help matters. And that was pretty much the beginning of the end for the Spanish Empire. After that, it was just Britain and Holland and a little bit of France contesting the international waters. And we kind of ruled the coup for the 17th century. And the British pretty much took over late 18th century and were, of course, the world power in the 19th century, basically painting the globe red.
Yeah, yeah.
There you go. And after World War II, of course, the United States took over all those sea lanes that the British were managing.
Yeah, yeah.
Trade, man.
Yeah, that's money. It all comes down money. To money.
And that's what the Civil War is about, money, even though... Yeah. The so-called rebels you see in this movie are all high-minded and say, well, we're doing this for that, the other. In reality, it was just, we don't want to pay tax. We just want to rule ourselves. We just want a democracy.
Yeah.
Our own we don't government. Need a king.
Yeah.
We'd like to, we would prefer to elect our officials. Thank you very much.
Well, I guess we should dive in, huh?
Well, and here we go. Here you have Mel Gibson's character, who is a pacifist, who makes nice speeches but does not want to go to war, to the chagrin of his neighbors. Now, I've thought a little bit about this, watching this movie, knowing what I know about history, and I have decided, no, I am not going to worry about historical accuracy here. I'm going to respect the artistic license they take, and I am going to treat this movie the way it should be treated, as a comedy. It's fun. It's fun for the whole family. There is nothing in this movie that is even remotely insulting in any way, except maybe some people are bludgeoned to death in very nasty ways. The British are basically portrayed as Nazis.
Yes, yes, they certainly are. They Which certainly is are. That's
the
very
only
clear.
Historical point I am just going to add to this. British officers did not burn people inside a church. British officers did not order wounded men to be shot. British officers were gentlemen, and they would never be able to go home if they committed atrocities on American colonists who just 5 minutes before were loyal British subjects. They could not go home if they pulled that one.
And it's I forgot the guy's name that plays him, but Cornwallis, who says that, like, after this skirmish is over,
we're all going to be friends
again. Business.
Basically, the British just saw it as an incident and thought of it in terms of, well, we'll just give them a few bloody noses.
Yeah, yeah.
Because they could, because they were the de facto military power of that time. They had the best
big brother. The colony's big brother that gets them into a headlock, gives them a couple of noogies, and that's the end of it.
I mean, the only guys who came remotely close to threatening Britain was France, of course, Napoleon.
I'll tell you what, though. The guy, Jason Isaacs, who plays Tavington, need a bad guy. You need a bad guy in a movie like this. And he is a fantastic bad guy. He's the bad guy that you despise. And you see every role that Jason Isaacs takes after this, you see Tavington.
Oh, he's typecast.
Yeah. Even in I don't know, Armageddon, he was a good guy scientist, but you still see Tavington in his face because he's that bad of a bad guy, mm-hmm. you know? So I thought for that reason, yeah, they blew a lot of that out of proportion, way out of proportion, where, like you said, the English were gentlemen fighters. They were gentlemen leaders. So there wasn't really anybody. I mean, you know, they compared him to one guy. I lost the name here, who was let me see, Tarleton.
Mm-hmm. Tarleton, who was maligned.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not only by this movie, but also by history.
Yeah. So he was a guy who took some liberties. Right. And
yes. Well, according to American propaganda.
Yeah, according to Wikipedia, my source for everything.
Ah, Wikipedia, yes.
But, you know, I mean, but they, like you said, there was nobody like this. The English weren't that bad.
No, however, the rebels, Benjamin Martin, quote unquote, is patterned after a violent psychopath.
Was he a French fox,
Francis Marion?
Was he a French and Indian war hero, like he's
but like they suggest, portrayed in the book? It's a little unclear, but he did fight in the Seven-Year War, and he did commit a ton of atrocities, both in that war and in this one. He just wasn't a very nice guy.
A serial rapist who hunted Red Indians for fun.
There you go.
Yeah, that says enough right there.
Yeah, but that's not considered a war crime in that time. So you have to judge it by the time.
Yeah.
And so it's a comedy. It's funny. It's funny, haha.
I'll tell you what, there were more than one time, because in the way that only Mel can deliver, he did make me laugh.
He did?
Yeah, he's...
Back with the dogs is great.
Yeah, yeah, the dogs, the thing rocking with the chair.
Yeah. I mean, that has callback.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, and he delivers that, like, you know, that exasperation without any dialogue. He just sits in a rocking chair that works, and he just throws his hands up like, what am I doing wrong? All my rocking chairs break. Acting. Yeah, yeah. So when I said that some of the acting was awful, I'm not referring to Mel. Mel, no, nope. You know, Mel nope. Went for it.
He did not phone it in.
Yeah,
certainly not. No, he knew what he came to do. I don't think the director was on the same page, however, because he made some interesting choices, which I find immensely funny, like the romance.
Ugh. Why?
The awkward romance with the sister-in-law.
Yeah. Why,
not
why
to mention to the awkward romance of the son with the girl in town.
Now, she's who I'm referring to when I say bad acting.
Ugh.
When she delivered that, I don't know, Eleanor Roosevelt speech about joining the fight, I was rolling my eyes through the whole thing.
Yes.
She was terrible.
Yes.
I don't know who she was or what she's been in before or since.
She's an 18th century Karen to the best of intentions.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I wasn't into her.
I don't think anyone is. I found some very interesting scenes with the slaves. Oh no, they weren't slaves. They were freemen.
Freemen.
Sure. Freemen. Yeah. Yeah.
They work for the Martins.
Yes, and they are
introduced in South Carolina.
In South Carolina. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Give me a break.
And they're introduced in a very interesting way, because you see Mel tied to apparently they don't have livestock to pull the ox, so tilling the land, Mel carrying that thing, and the freed slave or whatever he is walking next to him almost as if he's on a leash. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, artistic license there.
Yeah,
let's not insult anybody. Let's not go there. Let's just slide down the surface of things and pretend this is how it was with our fictitious comedic character.
There was the one Benjamin slave. Martin. There was the one slave that fights with the militia that that Donald Logue's character like has an issue with in the beginning.
Yes,
and his
but just the beginning, mind you. Then they're best buddies.
That's what I mean. Like his turnaround where at the end he's like, you know, I'm honored to fight next to you. It seems like a forced thing. It doesn't need to be in the movie at all.
It's completely, completely unintentional comedy.
Let me give you an example of how something like that works. Did you ever see the movie Glory?
Oh, yes.
I love that movie.
With Matthew Broderick and some other
Morgan Freeman, Denzel.
Yeah,
that is it's a easily top 10 favorite movie of mine.
Yeah,
and there was you know, the movie is about the first Black Regiment in the American Civil War,
mm-hmm.
and there's a group of white soldiers that march past this Black Regiment at one point, and mm-hmm. you know, they have a scuffle because the white soldiers and the Black soldiers get into it a little bit, and then at the end of the film, when the Black Regiment volunteers to hit the fort, knowing that there's going to be mass casualties, being the first regiment to go in,
yeah,
that same white soldier that had a problem, as the Black Regiment is walking past, said, "Give them hell, 52nd or whatever."
Yeah,
whatever,
but then it's earned.
Yes, it was. It was earned. And sure. that was earned. This was not. It seemed forced.
Yes. I mean, the horrors of the battle and what they were about to be thrown into
mm-hmm.
Made it believable that respect would be there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas here.
Yeah. I don't know what they were going for. I mean, you have one guy in the 1700s that thinks less of a Black man.
Mm-hmm.
One guy.
Yeah, the rest of them are like, hey, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, he's just another soldier.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I don't see a difference.
I don't know. It just seemed like there's no payoff to that. There's no satisfying feeling to it, you know?
I didn't find there to be any payoff for, well, anything really.
What about the little daughter who wouldn't speak and then she speaks? Yeah.
Reminded me of Scrooged.
Oh, the kid?
Yeah, and they did that better in Scrooged. Yeah.
Yes.
So
it did.
To me, it felt like, well, they lifted it because we need her to be more sympathetic. How do we do that? Oh, and somebody watched Scrooge and says, oh, I remember that one. That's how they did it. Well, we'll just steal that.
But that was another one when she wouldn't speak and you know, she was angry at the dad for leaving. And then he has to leave again and she chases him teary eyed, chases him. Daddy, I'll say whatever you want me to say.
Yeah.
It just like, I feel like that was supposed to be this big, you know, chill inducing moment, you mm-hmm. know, you're supposed to tears streaming down your face because it's so touching and yes. endearing, but there was nothing there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Doesn't really pull the heartstrings, does it?
No, it's supposed to, but I don't know if you felt the same about that, but
no, I don't like this movie, but you do.
You know, I did.
Yes.
I did
what like did you it. Like? Let's put it that way.
I like the set the battles? Pieces. I even the, man, there was that one scene where Lord Covington or Cornwallis was
mm-hmm.
he hated his horse blanket jacket. There was that ball, that party or whatever on some plantation in South Carolina or something,
mm-hmm.
Virginia, wherever they were. And like that, the spanning landscape right on the river there, you know, that it was gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
The big battlefield.
Oh, well shot.
The
cinematography is beautiful.
The cinematography, yes. That's the battlefields, the battles themselves,
mm-hmm.
the fighting seemed real. You know, and,
yeah.
and they went through a boot camp. They went through a boot camp and they were talking.
Actually,
they were,
well, no, I'm not gonna debate the inaccuracies. There's no point. This is a comedy. And in comedies, you don't debate the reality of it. It's about the joke. And I mean, the joke is that if you have like a realistic Civil War setting, mm-hmm. If you shoot a cannonball through these tightly packed lines, the carnage is going to be awful.
Yeah.
There's bodies everywhere and limbs everywhere, and they have mm-hmm. to carry these people back, and those limbs have to be sawed off, and
mm-hmm.
horrible battlefield medicine and
mm-hmm.
screaming everywhere, and the yes. lines need to be dressed so you're stepping over your former comrades to close the lines to get closer to the enemy so you can finally fire in line, you can fire volley. And the way it's depicted here
mm-hmm.
is very comical because it reminds me of Star Wars. It's like the British soldiers are all stormtroopers and they can't mm-hmm. shoot straight ever.
Yeah. You know, rather than the cannonballs rolling into the line and ripping guys' legs off and bouncing and taking a guy's head off,
mm-hmm.
I liked when they showed a wide shot of like the, you know, the big spanning battlefield, and you see in the distance like an explosion of a cannonball here,
mm-hmm.
and on the other side there's an explosion of a cannonball.
They would have used canister.
Yeah, mortars, whatever.
I mean, even
know, they use at the time
in your national anthem, the rockets' red glare.
Yeah,
the British used rockets. They used the form of offensive fireworks. They had an actual battalion that would set off rockets into the enemy to confuse the horses, to create mayhem.
Right. Yeah, they're you know, in modern warfare, they call them mortars. Yeah,
because this all these battles are essential to your culture. Because you would lose, you lost every battle, but still won the war.
Now, you mentioned the cinematography, which I thought was you know, probably the best thing about the movie.
Best thing about the movie, definitely.
There are a couple of shots. The first ambush.
It's great to watch.
With Mel and his two sons. Like, he's crouched behind a tree, right? Waiting for the soldiers.
That horrible ambush.
Him and his two boys kills 20 men.
Where these battle-hardened war veterans of the French war react like stormtroopers and are picked off one by one guy and his two children.
Yeah.
Just and three muskets.
With their dicks in their hands.
Yeah.
But there's this one shot when he's crouched behind a tree, and when he goes to aim, like he aims his rifle around the tree, and the camera sweeps around him and follows him as he leans around the tree and aims at the soldier. Like, that was a beautiful shot. So, I mean, I'd like to give credit where credit's due, you know.
The horse riding looks great.
Yeah. The slow motion stuff. I was into it, man. I like the things like when, you know, when the Reverend gets shot and he throws up his rifle and there's Gabriel to catch it and take a shot at Tavington, you know, that's the kind of stuff I was into.
Yeah. And you have like this nice, slowly building rivalry with Tavington going, throw everything but the kitchen sink at making that guy the most horrible, atrocious bad guy you could possibly imagine. He's a baby killer, basically.
He sure is. And not for nothing, Ben's first kid that gets killed, the 15-year-old, he deserved it.
Yeah, annoying little brat.
Yeah, what are you doing?
Well, I think he knew what he was doing because that's why he was playing with his tin soldiers all that time.
Yeah, and he wanted to enlist, but he was too young. So I get that he wanted to be a hero. But you're surrounded by British troops, and
you were completely underestimating. Well, not in this movie, of course, because they're bumbling stormtroopers. But in reality, different story.
Well, his answer is to throw his body into one guy and tell Gabriel to run.
Yeah,
like how far is anybody going to get?
Great move.
So he deserved that.
I mean, in reality, they would have whacked that kid around the ears and said, go back to your mother, you know?
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Knock it off. Not Tavington, though.
No. Actually, at first, I thought he was a loyalist American.
Oh, Adam.
Yeah. That's what I found most interesting. He's actually the guy who commits the atrocity. He's the one who throws the first flame into the church.
Yeah,
he's gonna go home after that.
Yeah, he was reluctant to do so, but
sort of. It's your duty, really. It's your duty to commit an atrocity. There were tribunals back then.
Yeah, and war crimes are still war crimes, weren't they?
They're civilians.
It was
women, old people, children,
defenseless, unarmed.
Yeah, so you immediately hate them. You want them to be defeated at the end of the movie. It's very important.
Yeah, I get that. But all right, you want to make a revolutionary war? You could have set this in, you know, in a concentration camp in Nazi Germany, and you know that those were real evil
people. It's a German director. So maybe he had a point to make.
Oh, maybe he was saying
it's a little unclear what kind of point he was making.
It wasn't just the Germans, the British were doing this shit too.
Yes, even if I have to make it up.
Yeah. Well, it kind of maybe takes a little bit of focus. I mean, shit, the whole, you know, brutality to the Nazis wasn't that much of a debate back in in 2000.
No, and it wasn't a debate in the 18th century either, because you had the Prussian army, and they were as brutal back then as the SS would be a couple centuries later. I mean, the Totenkopf division is the Death Hand division. That was a Prussian regiment.
Yeah.
Right? And So look, that's nothing new.
Brutality like that has been going on as long as warfare has been a thing. Genghis Khan and his men, Mongolian army, they were as brutal as they came.
They perfected the craft.
Yeah, they own like two-thirds of the world at some point.
Yep. Yeah, in fact, Genghis Khan fathered most of the royal lines in Asia, and they lasted for centuries.
There's some outrageous statistic, like, you know, so many people living today are have a direct descendants to Genghis Khan. That's outrageous.
Good stuff. So, well, Harrison Ford was actually offered the role.
I saw that.
He thought it was too violent. And he said, we're boiling down the Revolutionary War down to a personal revenge story. What is this?
Yeah, exactly. So he saw through the bullshit. Harrison Ford doesn't, I don't know if he would have been right for this.
No, I don't think so. Not at all.
I'm trying to think in 2000, who were the hot names? I mean, Nicolas Cage was pretty hot back then.
Brendan Fraser?
That's interesting.
He could have worked.
That's interesting. I could see that.
Yeah. He had too much class to do this as well. However, John Williams made a great score. I did love the score.
Yes. I will take nothing away from the music. I always say the score makes the movie.
And John Williams had a great score. Not the greatest score he's ever done, but it did get a nomination.
Well, this is the kind of movie where you needed it to bump up those artificially, fed moments of drama.
It's a Williams score makes the film epic. Mm-hmm. This creates the sense of the tentpole movie, the summer blockbuster, the big movie of the year. We're doing the Revolutionary War. But the music does sell it.
I can still remember the trailer with the music and him running across the battlefield with the flag.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It was a score makes a...
Yes, we know how weepy-eyed Americans become when they see a man heroically running with the American flag.
So in a movie like Glory, the score, and I keep going back to it, I apologize, but the score enhances the drama, it enhances the action. In a movie like this, the score creates the drama. It creates because
when it's not there.
Yeah, you need that. You need the score to say, okay, you're supposed to be feeling something at this moment.
Because turn the sound off and you're looking at a very different movie.
Yes.
You think it's a comedy.
You know, even
it has to be. From all the looks these people give each other.
Yeah. The tea that's got ink in it, you know, that's a really gut busting moment. But again, taking nothing away from Mel, even in the dramatic moments where his son is killed and you know, he's supposed to be emoting, he does.
Yes.
And you feel it. You feel the pain in him.
Yeah. Like I said, he's in a different movie than everyone else.
Yeah. And I felt Heath Ledger did a pretty good job too. He wasn't the problem in this either.
No, he can hold his own.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a few years away from the Joker, but still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've identified a few areas, actors who were the problem. You know, I mean, anything else that comes to mind?
In terms of this movie?
Yeah, like where it lacked and, you know, what
pacing.
Yeah, that's true.
I had a real pacing problem with this one.
2 hours and 45 minutes.
Yeah, and it feels like four.
Yeah.
Because they don't have much of a plot. And if you have a 2.5 hour movie and you have no plot, it starts to drag.
And it was less about the war itself and more about, you know, Ben Martin's family issues. You know, and that, I mean, that can only, maybe if they incorporated more of the issues that we were, why we were at war, mm-hmm. instead of just, you know, the militia is advancing to stop Cornwallis from, from taking Charlestown or whatever the fuck, mm-hmm. you know, get a little more, you know, analytical as far as like the war. Mm-hmm. In there, and I think like you pepper in,
you know, or pump up the comedy, pump up the comedy. Don't worry about really, it.
I mean, this is a Mel Gibson movie,
so historical accuracy is not a prized possession anyway. Mm-hmm. Pump up the comedy, please.
We've talked about that.
Make me laugh. Just make me laugh. Mm-hmm. I mean, the guy who played Tarleton could have done with a good joke. Oh, he did have some. Straight man jokes where he's kind of the butt of the joke. I did enjoy that.
Yeah. I also like when the ship blows up and he chugs the martini and slams the glass on the ground.
Right.
That was a good moment.
That was a good gag. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, you're right.
It's an enjoyable movie. There's elements that are just, you know, you could tell they cared and you could tell they were trying to make it work. And it does in some cases. It's just, I think if they, fix the plot and fix the pacing, not put like these ridiculous modern sensibilities into it.
Right. Yeah.
And I think the worst thing was the representation of 18th century romance in such a way that it's just grating.
Mm-hmm. Right? The young couple.
Yeah, where they're sewn into the bed and stuff like that. I'm sure that happened at some point. I mean, sure, Americans tend to be like, you know, religious and a little, how shall we say it?
Rude.
Sensitive.
Yeah.
Is that a good word?
That's a kind word for it.
Yes. Sensitive to things of a, let's say, sexual nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they go to the extent, to great lengths to take care of making sure that the Smithsonian oversaw the costumes to make sure that they were historically accurate.
Yes. And the irony was they were nominated for it. And when you ask experts, they just tear it apart completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that's not how things work. Right. Like, for example, the regimental colors don't match the uniforms.
Oh, is that
and
right?
The uniforms are all the same, whereas every regiment in an army would have those regimental colors represented in their uniform. So they would have like green lapels if their flags were like had green in them, etc. Mm-hmm. So they were all different. That's how you could tell them apart. That's the point.
Right.
That's why they're all wearing these bright uniforms, because this is really a set piece battle. It's the height and the peak of the set piece battle. And generals would place regiments at a certain point in the field, and the regimental colors would be used as the communication key. It's like, okay, this regiment is here, that regiment is there, and they all had specialties.
Hmm.
That's part of the deal. The British had every regiment had its own thing. So, like I said, they had an engineering group, they had a rocket group, they had the rifles, they had et cetera. So they would all have different uniforms. They wouldn't all be red. Yes, they would be red. They would have some red coats, but with differentiation. You don't see that. Nobody in the Smithsonian cared, apparently. Or
I guess
more
not.
Likely, nobody listened to them. And that's more likely.
Well, I mean, when you're sacrificing,
because this director was just doing his own thing.
Yeah, and they didn't give a shit about being historically accurate with the story. So why care that closely about the uniforms?
They wanted to make it look cool and be have effective scenes. And to a degree, they succeeded. It's not almost a bad movie. It's just not a very good one.
It's almost like they were chasing the one Oscar or another, you know, like they made this movie in order
to win
grab
stuff.
An Oscar.
Best movie of the year or something like that,
or cinematography or costumes, or, you know,
not for Roland Emmerich.
I mean, who would even be out for the best actress? Would it be Aunt Charlotte?
Good grief.
You know, I mean, no. Obviously Mel had the chops to
grab. I mean, all the women in this movie are cardboard.
Speaking of which, did it get nominated for any?
No. The only thing that got nominated for was the costuming and the sound.
Yeah.
And best cinematography.
Okay.
Obviously, because it's good. And they got an People's Choice for favorite movie actor, Mel, because he got a MTV award for best acting. This was in the day when MTV awards were a thing. Remember the MTV awards?
Yeah, yes.
Which was supposed to be like the next big acting chop you could get. You know, it would be like third or fourth in line after the Oscars and the Globes and
Yeah, like people, I mean, people goofed around, but it was like a serious...
For a while, it was a very, very serious thing.
Yeah.
Before they started inventing categories to fit movies. Yeah, that was awkward.
So I'll give a little nod to the cinematographer, Caleb Deschanel, who you might know, the name might sound familiar. Emily and Zoe Deschanel are his daughters.
They are Hollywood brats, eh?
Hollywood brats, for sure. Did he do any other big cinematography? The Natural.
Beautiful movie.
The Right Stuff, yeah.
Not a beautiful movie.
Sawyer's Wife, It Could Happen to You, Fly Away Home, Hope Floats, National Treasure. Oh, he did The Passion of the Christ with Mel.
Oh, that's not surprising. Mel must have seen his stuff and liked it.
Yeah. Yeah, so the guy's bona fide. He's got some...
Because The Passion of the Christ is, I think, Mel Gibson's most important personal movie. That's just like his dream movie.
With an already controversial person, he upped the ante on that one. He got people talking.
There you go. I mean, well, you know, when you're a filmmaker and you're religious, mm-hmm. when you get to make a movie about Jesus with a lot of dough to make the movie, you have to be happy, especially if it succeeds. Right. And it succeeded. Right,
yeah. And of course.
And so did this film. I mean, the budget was stupendous. I mean, it made it cost $110 million, which was a lot of money for that time. Mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't Lord of the Rings money, but it was a lot of money. And it
basically doubled, too.
And it doubled because they had 3,000 theaters and a great opening weekend. So, hey, Mel's star power was still going strong. And let's face it, he does sell this movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mel on the poster helps.
Yeah, for sure.
You believe it. It's like, oh, yeah, I want to see this guy kick some British ass. I want to see this guy play revolutionary with PTSD.
Yeah, and you don't need anything else. You don't have anything else on the poster, just Mel's gigantic face.
Yes, I could have done without the family B-plot, the drama. If they just kept that out, if they just make it like one of his men dies a horrible death by falling into the hands of the British and he's tortured or hung, you know, something tragic, that could have worked too. That they all turn, you know, homicidal because you get angry when one of your comrades gets killed.
I liked when he ambushed the Redcoats getting Gabriel back, I liked that he brought his younger sons to help him.
Yes, because like you want to engage your children in warfare as early as possible. Getting young, the possibilities are endless.
Well, the way I looked at it was he needed more guns and mm-hmm. that he didn't have, mm-hmm. and he's running out of kids, so he's got to go to the next two sons and say, look, we got to get your brother back. So you're going to help.
Yeah,
you know it's you do go your from part. You go
your
from
stupid
being
brother screwed up.
Yeah, yeah.
So now you have to fix his mistake. That's basically the lesson.
Yeah. One moment he's a 12-year-old kid, the next moment he's, you know, a man.
Yep. You're next in line, kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, basically, if you're in Africa and your country is in a civil war, then when you're 12 years old, you're probably an NCO.
Yeah.
Because they usually have a senior officer who's an adult. They put the teens in charge of the non-teens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amazing.
That's how it works.
But you also think, you think about this too. You got, obviously you have to hunt for your food. So your kids are going to know how to shoot. Mm-hmm. And two, you're living in a place where there's war being fought in your backyard.
Yes.
So the kids might need to learn how to defend themselves sooner or later.
Sure. Or their sisters.
Yeah.
Which is what that creepy brother says to them. Right. It's like, well, you know, they might do unspeakable things to you. And I'm like,
oh,
really?
Yeah,
we're going there?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we could have used without that.
That should have been cut. Yeah, there was a little bit of a... Well, it was great comic relief. I laughed.
Yeah.
You know who really disappointed me, though? René Auberjonois.
Oh, yeah. The father, right? The reverend?
Yeah. Yeah, one of the other rebels, right? And he just disappointed me. I'm a big fan of his from Deep Space Nine. I'm a Star Trek fan. And,
oh, okay.
You know, it's like, come on.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, TV actors getting a small part in a movie, that's a big thing.
Yeah, he wasn't given much to do.
No.
You know?
His character made no sense to me.
Yeah, it's like they needed
someone to catch a bullet.
Yeah, exactly.
To me, the trouble with this movie is it didn't have stakes. Mm-hmm. Why was this battle fought? It's not explained.
Right.
Well, vaguely.
Right.
There's a lot of complaining about how the Americans are generaling this war, and the French need to come and help. And of course they do, because the British know what they're doing. They don't look in the movie like they know what they're doing, but in reality, they knew precisely what they were doing. So,
yeah. What about, speaking of the war itself, Chris Cooper's character?
Mm-hmm.
I thought he also did a good job he wasn't given much to do either.
No.
But I thought he did a decent job of what he was given.
Well, in many ways, they just looked at Braveheart and say, hey, let's just do this. Set it in the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, but Braveheart had real stakes to it. Braveheart, you know, you well knew written. Why. Yeah, you knew why William Wallace was doing what he did.
Yeah.
You know.
But then again, Mel as Martin makes the same nice rousing speeches, has the same faltering of his morale at some point, has the same violent streak. So essentially, he's playing the same guy, but in a different era.
Yeah, the first guy that he tomahawks to death, and all the blood is splattering all over him. It's just like
it gave
that
me
scene
Braveheart vibes.
In Braveheart, yeah.
Yep. And that's what it gives everybody. So it's in many ways this movie is successful because it's reminiscent of what we covered in last season, the greatest battlefield movie ever done.
Right, yeah, those sweeping battle scenes, the big, large, wide open, mano a mano.
Second to none.
Yeah. You got the line against line, you know. It wasn't until World War One when they invented foxholes and trench warfare, you know.
Oh, they had those before. They had those in the Civil War. In fact, it was Southern generals who invented a lot of that stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Hmm. I thought they were still doing.
Well, at some point, they lost the initiative, and so they had to go on the defensive. So they had defense in depth, especially around Vicksburg, those kinds of places.
Yeah.
They were fairly static for a long time, and it was only broken from the deadlock because they had Sherman run through it, who was just vicious, even to his own men.
Yeah.
If you really look at it, it's the time span between the Revolutionary War, the War of 1812, and the Civil War is extremely short.
Yeah.
That's like, I mean, one of those children could live through all of them.
Yeah. You're talking about 30 years in between wars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's a grandfather by the time the Civil War starts, but hey, he's in the Carolinas.
Right. Yeah. Right in the thick of it.
Because the 1812 War wasn't much fun either. Not for the Americans anyway. That's why you have the White House.
That's one we don't learn much about.
No, it didn't go very well.
Yeah, I guess so. Interesting.
Let's not talk about history. That one. That's a blip in history. Let's just forget about that one. Doesn't fit the propaganda.
Right.
Yeah. Let's go immediately to the war with Mexico. That's great. Yeah. We squashed those guys.
Right. Right. Yeah. We don't always come out looking, you know, like, you know, shiny and nice, do we?
No, not exactly. No.
No.
No, it's really makes you wonder when if we're currently on the right side of history, doesn't it? Yeah.
Oof.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's a discussion for another.
Because the reason why the Revolutionary War worked, because the British were just sick of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They quit. They just quit. They were like, hey, if you want this stupid colony so much, you can have it. It's just not worth the effort.
Right.
That's basically it. It's because they were in a deadlock with France, and they just needed their resources elsewhere because France was pressing them in Asia and other places. So they were like, well, you know, we have to make a choice here. What are we going to do? Well, and let them rot.
Yeah, I guess, you know.
They basically withdrew.
It was, they just left. It was probably the, you know, they weighed their options, and that might have been the path of least resistance.
Yeah.
You know, just give them the colonies and call it a day.
We'll be back later.
Well.
And then the United States invaded Canada and, well, Mexico. That didn't work out very well.
Well, it all adds up to a wonderful Mel Gibson movie.
Well, the movies. Well, Mel Gibson is fun in it. That's really what we're really talking about.
Yeah, he's classic Mel. Mel at his peak.
Yeah, this is still a well. It's autumn Mel, in my opinion, because he's like you know, fraying a little bit at the temples.
Okay.
This is kind of the start of what I would like to call Mel's classic era.
Classic. He, you know, he has a unique way of taking these drama parts and kind of adding his Mel flair to it to, you know, get a little chuckle out of you. And he delivers.
Yeah. And that's why I'm telling people, look, just don't think about the history. Just watch it as a comedy.
If you could sit through 2 hours and 45 minutes of it.
Yeah. You might want to fast forward a couple of times.
This is 3 hour movies were all the rage. You know, back in this time.
Yeah. And then they went back to like normal format. And then all of a sudden, like now we're in like these 4 hour long sit throughs.
Superhero movies. And
yeah. Or you know, worse, instead of a movie, you get a mini series of 8 episodes and it's an 8 hour movie instead of a 2 hour one. They could have like taken out a good 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
I would not miss.
Yeah.
And that would make me enjoy it all the more.
Right. Make it less about his kids, more about the war.
Yes. Take some of the SS behavior out of the British soldiers. Right. You know, don't hang prisoners. Don't kill children in front of their parents and don't burn civilians. And
Yeah. A lot of good people die in this.
Yes.
You know?
Need I explain that this movie is not particularly popular in Britain?
It's not. I don't imagine why. Really portrays them as monsters.
Yeah. And you do not grasp why. Well, for the intensive purposes of we need a villain in this movie.
Yeah.
They need to be bad guys. Bad. And bad men do bad things.
Very bad.
So, but they're bad to the point of comedic.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, especially when Benjamin comes to the British General Cornwall and gets his prisoners of war released by subterfuge. That was just funny.
Yeah, the dummies that were dressed up as British officers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, good for you, Mel.
Yeah,
you pulled got one over. On,
yeah. Yeah, and yeah, I mean, they see things like that worked. You know,
it was, they could have done more stuff like that. It would have been cute.
It was like the British were the heels, and you know. It's that part is
and the bad and the good guys are always smarter and will always outsmart the bad guys. And
right.
It felt episodic, an episodic TV show.
Yeah, yeah. So if you make the British more like bumbling, foolish, then you know, over the top villainous, you know, then pick a lane is I guess
pick
is what
a lane.
I'm saying
they can't be bumbling idiots and homicidal maniacs.
Right,
in the same movie.
Time. Right, right.
It doesn't work that way.
Well, I don't know. Are you going to watch this one again?
Probably at some point. Sure. Yeah.
Just for the pure comedy of it.
Yeah. I have already alluded to this on another episode. I am considered by my my equals on this channel to be somewhat polarizing. And a lot of people are a big fan of this movie. So wow. I really welcome the others to cover this movie in any way they see fit. If they love this movie and they enjoy it, then they should definitely cover it and give their personal opinion on the matter and profess their love of it.
I've never heard another podcast cover this movie, so I'm really curious to see where other people stand on it.
Yes, so am I. So that should be interesting. Yeah, well, you know, we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see. And so, but it did bring up some interesting discussions.
Yeah, I think we had a good back and forth.
Oh, I almost invited Jack on this from the Bond Drunk Bond podcast because he loved this movie. So that would have been fun.
Yeah, he could have enlightened us more on like the
and Southern... we could have done this drunk and laughed a lot more.
Yeah, I bet. Actually, that probably would have been a great idea. So just with a little bourbon in you.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know, some of that Carolina hooch.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, right, because right. There's a thing. I did not understand the geography much, and I really didn't understand. Were there at that point parts of the United States liberated by the rebels, and were there like actual lines? I didn't think so. I thought the British were occupiers, and they would fight the occasional skirmish with a militia.
Yeah. Well, I think
the Americans called it the Continental Army, but that was more a notion in name only because they would be trounced at every battle.
Yeah. It's like the British own the land and they let the colonists use it.
So the colonists were the Viet Cong, really. They were hiding by day and they would congregate and attack when they could mass enough men.
And I think when the British, the parts of the war, like when he talks about, you know, conquering South Carolina, Charlestown, and moving into Virginia, like he's squashing the military forces that were in those areas. Mm-hmm. You know, you squash the military force in South Carolina, then you can move north to the next military force in North Carolina, and then to Virginia, and so on and so forth until...
Yeah.
You know, you control the military as well.
Yeah.
So, I don't know.
But basically, the Americans won, quote unquote, because they fought with asymmetrical warfare. They basically attacked the supply lines and created kind of an attritional situation where the British would be constantly undersupplied and there would be no value to defend the colony because there would never be any profit to the situation. It was supposed to be a profitable war.
Yeah,
they should at least get some tea out of it, but even that was thrown into harbor.
Yeah, all those old legends, you know.
Yes, and is at this point Philadelphia the capital
of what? The United States?
The United States?
Washington D.C.
Yeah, but the Philadelphia was the capital at some point.
I think Washington was always the capital. Philadelphia was like the first settled city.
Okay.
So I guess it might have been the capital at one point. But I think during this time, it was definitely Washington, D.C.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting.
So will you watch this movie again?
Me? Trying to find 3 hours to sit down and watch a movie is tough these days.
Yes, you're starting another family.
Yeah, trying.
Full disclosure, Doug has remarried.
That's right. This one
is pro-podcast.
She's pro-podcast, but I got, you know, it's so many balls in the air that I'm finding it hard to podcast. Yeah, will I watch this again? I can see a time when I watch it again. I'm not going to ever put it on. If I'm like flipping through the channels and it's on, I'll stop on it, you know, watch it for a bit. But I'm probably not going to seek it out. You know, oh, look, the Patriot's on Amazon Prime, you know.
It is. Yes, that's where I watched it. Yeah.
I watched on Hulu. Yeah, we have it on Hulu here.
Okay. There you go.
It's not as terrible of a movie. It didn't do that bad on Rotten Tomatoes. It got 62%.
It's not bad. It's not very good. It just is.
Yeah. It's, you know, again, it's like when any of the action movies from the era that we love so much.
Yeah.
If you watch the movie for what it is, you mm-hmm. keep that in mind, you'll enjoy it. Mm-hmm. If you're expecting something that, you know, something big, some big message, some big, you know, emotional drama, you're not going to get it.
It lacks in two essential elements. You make no emotional connection with the character and his family, whereas in Braveheart, you immediately do. You feel for that, for William Wallace. And that makes the battles more important. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, you automatically assume, well, he's going to win.
Yeah. Yeah, right. You never at one point think that he's in danger.
No. There, like I said, there are no stakes. And also, the actual battle isn't as exciting mm-hmm. as Braveheart was.
No, because it wasn't enough of the focus of the movie.
True. You know? True. So those two elements did not reward the viewer. Because right. you came into this movie from that poster and that flag expecting magnificence.
Yes. Yeah. And it came up a little short.
They're going to show us how the Americans beat the British.
Right.
I guess they showed it.
I guess. All right. All right.
Another thing that bothered me, why would Cornwallis have two Great Danes?
I don't know.
I mean, they were a great gag, but still.
Yeah.
Not that enjoy Great Danes. They're great dogs. I love Great Danes, but still.
Yeah.
What is this Beastmaster ability that Mel's character has?
Yeah.
That is not set up at the start of the movie because they don't have domesticated animals because he's pulling pulling his own ox cart.
I guess the joke there was that Cornwallis thought that, you know, they were butchering the dogs and eating them and, mm-hmm. you know, he brings them back in good health and, you know, then he whistles and they go and follow him. He's treating them so good that they would rather be with him than with the good old Lord calling them.
Because they're American dogs.
Yeah.
The gags worked.
Yeah.
I'll give him that.
Yeah. An old bumbling Lord Cornwallis sold it well, too, with the faces that he made when the ship
blew
up. Yeah.
Great actor. And they did do him justice to a degree that he does dress down Tarlington, who's, you know, portrayed as basically a dishonorable officer. Mm-hmm. And he does dress him down for that. So basically you get the official British position. Like what you're doing is not helping anyone. So that's interesting. You know, you do get like the kind of the official stamp of approval is like, yes, no, we know what he's doing. Well, we tolerate him because he's effective, he's great in battle. And they do show that, you know, his cavalry does work, you know.
Yeah.
They're less bumbling than the infantry is.
Yeah, yes, he was an effective.
Which ironically, in reality, on battlefields the British were in, they would rely on their heavy infantry. Those men would be able to fire four times a minute, and the cavalry were usually officers because those were men who had to pay for their own horse and pay for their own uniform and pay for their own upkeep, because those would be paid for commissions. And
that's interesting.
Yes. And so the cavalry, if there's the famous case of the British cavalry going into battle at Waterloo, they were all drunk. So they thought they were winning, but Napoleon was strategically pulling back those forces to lure the cavalry in.
Oh.
And it turned into a disaster.
Yeah, a bloodbath.
Basically leaving the British without a good cavalry force. So they had to rely on their infantry.
Hmm. So you know a lot about history.
Napoleonic Wars? Yes, I love the Napoleonic Wars. They're awesome.
Nice.
So, Doug, thank you so much for sharing your love of the Patriots.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me on for this one.
Well, you commissioned me to do this movie, so I
twisted your arm.
To a degree. Well, I did get you to commit to Arnold because I would do this movie. So I'm happy to provide you with this platform. So thanks again for coming on and discussing this interesting movie with me. And for the male fans, please don't listen to me. This movie is fun and entertaining, and it will provide you with pleasure for many decades. I was just taking the piss a little bit because, well,
that's what you do.
It's what I do.
The internet's biggest troll, and we love you for it, buddy.
Hey, somebody has to. Somebody has to be both the voice of reason and the contrarian.
Agreed.
So there you have it. Well, Doug, what's next for you?
Next for me is, we're going to start hitting up season 2 of the Arnold podcast.
Yeah.
I'm slowly in drips and drabs releasing Rocky season 3 of Rocky Minute. And me, Ryan, and Craig, we're still trying to get together every now and then to do our monthly Stallone movie. Well, it's more than monthly these days, but I can't remember the last one we did even, but we're trying, man. A lot's going on. Life happens.
Yes, you have Paradise Alley and Rhinestone to go, I think.
Yeah, I think those are the ones that are up for up for vote this time around. So
yes, halfway decent movies. Well, at least Paradise Alley is. That's probably one of Stallone's best. And Rhinestone is one of those movies where you just die a little inside.
Still not his worst, though. Still not his worst.
No, the irony. Oh, right? The irony.
All right, folks.
The wrong brother heading Rhinestone.
Yeah.
Frank would have killed it.
Yeah, he would have.
Yes. If you'd have me on, that's what I would be arguing.
He fancies himself a singer.
The Sly does, yes.
Yeah, Sly does.
Mel doesn't. He doesn't sing.
No. God bless him.
Mel has dignity in that respect, at least. So thanks, Doug. Thanks for coming on.
Seagull,
everybody, thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time.
Adios.